Today is Friday, September 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. After the poisoning of Alexei Navalny and the events in Belarus,
Russia has been preparing for the possibility of future sanctions since the first wave in 2014.
Plus, what happens if you get the coronavirus and the seasonal flu?
We have not seen a large number of those co-infections, but that's probably because we've seen a dramatic drop in influenza cases.
And time's running out for beached whales in Australia. We'll have these stories and more next. The 75th United Nations General Assembly continued with its virtual speeches on Thursday, and here are just some of the highlights. Niger's President Mahamadou Issoufou called for a pure and simple cancellation of debt to help one of the world's poorest countries deal with the coronavirus pandemic. The King of Bahrain said his country's decision to normalize relations with Israel was to show Bahrain's commitment to security and stability of the region. King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa said Bahrain believes the deal is a step toward an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and said still Bahrain believes in the establishment of an independent Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. And Libya's Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj called on Thursday for the United Nations to support in holding presidential and parliamentary elections as the war-torn country remains split between rival administrations in the East and West, each backed by armored groups and foreign governments. Sarraj said elections next year could lead to democracy and end Libya's legitimacy crisis. VOA has ongoing and additional coverage from Thursday's UNGA on our website. Saturday is World Contraception Day, a day the UN has set aside to emphasize the importance of sexual and reproductive health and family planning and to support the providers of that care to women and girls everywhere. However, this year, the challenges to universal access to contraception and family planning are far greater than usual due to the coronavirus pandemic, which has interrupted the supply chains for contraceptive medicine and devices, and where coronavirus prevention and treatment has made routine gynecological and obstetric care harder to achieve, and sometimes with deadly consequences. Now, to find out more about these issues in Africa and elsewhere in the developing world, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Susan Papp, the Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at Women Deliver, a global NGO dedicated to the health and well-being of women and girls around the world. Ms. Papp began the interview by bluntly stating a simple truth.
Just because COVID has happened, people don't stop having sex and they don't stop having babies. But what we are finding is that there's been a disruption in access to sexual and reproductive health and rights services. And this disruption maps very well to what kind of disruption we saw in Africa with Ebola several years ago.
How so?
Supply chains are compromised. Services like access to contraception, wellness visits around family planning, access to safe abortion. And in some places where you have particularly strained health systems in Africa, sexual and reproductive health and rights services fall off because these systems are so strained.
Because of COVID?
Yes.
So what's the upshot of that? How does this falling off affect women?
So the Guttmacher Institute is a think tank. They, along with some UN agencies, have conducted a number of estimates on what it means when sexual and reproductive health and rights services are disrupted. As a result of these disruptions, 50 million more women have an unmet need for contraception. 16 million women are going to have unintended pregnancies. 200 million will experience major obstetric complications, and 1,000 additional maternal deaths are estimated to happen as a result of disruptions in services around reproductive and sexual health. So it's really alarming, the downstream effects of COVID, particularly to girls and women.
What is the remedy you suggest to right this balance?
I would say the UN systems and the governments need to recognize that sexual and reproductive health and rights are an essential part of services, that it's a non-negotiable. The UN General Assembly had several political statements that are going before all of the member states. One is an omnibus statement on COVID, and that omnibus statement rightly understands the gender dimensions of COVID. And so that's a positive sign. The World Health Organization also recognized the gender dimensions of COVID. The UN Secretary General has put out a COVID response and recovery plan that has gender dimensions included. But I think what we really need to ensure is that those aren't just words on a page, that it leads to action. And that action comes down to country leaders recognizing the normative guidance from the UN and following through on it.
Susan Papp is the Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at the NGO Women Deliver. She was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Additional Western sanctions against Russia could be back on the agenda, but even if imposed, the impact of any new sanctions would likely be muted. Reuters' Megan Ravel explains why.
Between Alexei Navalny's poisoning and the crisis in Belarus, Russia may be hit with more sanctions soon from Western countries. But this time, it may not be as worried as from previous hits. The impact would likely be muted. Russia has been preparing for the possibility of future sanctions since the first wave in 2014. These are the five ways it has laid the groundwork, starting with its reserves. Russia has the world's fourth largest gold and foreign currency reserves, which have been steadily building over 5 years. The central bank also let the ruble float freely in 2014, making it a safe valve against external shocks. Secondly is oil, Russia's main export. To shield itself from volatility in prices, the government changed its fiscal rule in 2017, so that any crude oil revenue over a certain price goes right into the state's coffers. When prices dip, Russia sells foreign currency, supporting the ruble. It's reduced its dependency on external markets, slashing foreign debt exposure and boosting domestic borrowing. Outstanding foreign debt has shrunk considerably over the years. Russia's also come up with other domestic buffers. For example, it's made its own credit card payment system, fearing it would get cut off from the likes of Visa and MasterCard. It's made its own bank messaging system, its own credit rating agency, and others, all reducing its dependency on the global financial system. Finally, it's reduced its reliance on imports. Russia has become more self-sufficient in food since it banned most Western imports in 2014. This ban and a weaker ruble have helped domestic producers flourish, reducing Russia's food imports by a third since 2013.
Megan Ravel reports for Reuters News. U.S. President Donald Trump on Wednesday said that he would not commit to a peaceful transfer of power if he loses the 2020 election and again questioned the legitimacy of an expected increase in mail-in voting due to the coronavirus pandemic. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany addressed the topic on Thursday during a press briefing.
The president will accept the results of a free and fair election. He will accept the will of the American people.
But recent polling indicates that significantly more Democrats plan to vote by mail than Republicans. VOA's Bryden Padden reports Trump's comments come as both parties prepare for the likelihood of a barely contested presidential election in November.
The partisan divide over mail-in voting could lead to what some pundits are calling a contested red mirage election. Under that scenario, President Trump might claim victory after securing an early lead on election night, but eventually lose to Democratic Party rival Joe Biden as absentee ballots are counted in the days that follow. Calling mail-in voting fraudulent and a scam, Trump predicts there could be legal challenges to the ballot count that would ultimately be decided by the Supreme Court. This is one reason he has cited for nominating a replacement to recently deceased liberal justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg before the election.
I think this will end up in the Supreme Court, and I think it's very important that we have nine justices.
Analysts note that while there is no evidence of widespread vote-by-mail fraud, as the president has alleged, these mail-in ballots do have a higher rejection rate, mostly because voters fail to fill them out properly. Also, as happened during this year's primary elections in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, some states experienced long delays in counting the surge of mail-in ballots. Hans von Spakovsky is a former federal election commissioner now at the Heritage Foundation.
The more you encourage people to vote by mail, the larger the number of people who will be disenfranchised and their votes aren't going to count.
The Supreme Court's role in all of this, if any, remains to be seen. Sam Berger is a political analyst at the Center for American Progress.
Hopefully we won't be in a situation in which we're asking justices to rule on a case that will decide the outcome of the election. I think that would be very problematic for democracy.
In the closely contested 2000 presidential election, the Supreme Court ruled on a vote recount dispute in Florida that essentially provided Republican George W. Bush a victory over former Democratic Vice President Al Gore by one electoral vote. Gore then conceded, saying it was for the good of the country, despite winning the overall popular vote. President Trump, when asked Wednesday if he would commit to a peaceful transfer of power if he loses the election, said only we are going to see what happens. With partisan tensions so high, both sides fear a bitterly contested election could spark political clashes between right-wing militias and radical leftists. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
Facebook's long-delayed independent oversight board plans to launch in mid or late October, just before the November U.S. presidential election, although a board member said that he did not know whether or not it would hear cases related to that contest. Reuters reporter Conway G. Gittins has more.
The board is charged with reviewing decisions regarding the removal of Facebook and Instagram posts. Oversight board member Alan Rusbridger, a former editor-in-chief of Britain's Guardian newspaper, told Reuters the board has been promised autonomy.
Facebook has promised they will respect our judgment on those cases of take down or leave out. So I guess if Facebook went against their word and didn't respect that promise, then that would raise serious questions about the credibility of the exercise.
Not part of the board's initial duties, reviewing complaints about what Facebook decides to leave up. Neither does it have oversight of Facebook ads or groups. That may not go down well with critics. The board was created by Facebook in response to criticism on how it handles problematic content, and that scrutiny has only grown. In recent months, Facebook employees have lashed out against company decisions not to take action over posts from President Trump containing misleading claims about mail-in voting, as well as violent threats against Black Lives Matter protests.
So, no, we haven't done a Trump case.
Advertisers and celebrities have also staged numerous boycotts, accusing Facebook of spreading and profiting from hate and misinformation. On the other hand, Republicans have accused Facebook, among other social media platforms, of discriminating against conservative viewpoints and suppressing their free speech. Russ Bridger knows his group has a delicate balance on its hands.
God knows there's enough misleading and hateful speech on social media. We know that. But there's an awful lot that is incredibly precious. You know, 300 years of dealing with those kind of issues about how you protect free speech, but deal with bad speech, as it were. And when sometimes you have to allow bad speech as the penalty for having free speech.
The oversight board will be asked to make a ruling only after a user has exhausted Facebook's appeal process. The decision will be made within 90 days or even sooner if the request is deemed as having, quote, urgent real-world consequences.
That was Reuters' Conway G. Gittins. And still to come,
DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, that also has seen a sharp increase in violence and armed violence and insecurity, particularly in its northeastern province of Ituri, which has also led to, as Syria, 1.4 million new displacements.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
People living near the North and South Poles who look up to the night sky are often treated to natural light shows called auroras. Scientists say these shimmering waves of colored light are the result of the interaction of highly charged particles of the solar wind with the magnetosphere that surrounds and protects Earth. Auroras have also been spotted on other planets and moons within the solar system. After analyzing data gathered by the various instruments aboard ESA's Rosetta spacecraft, a team of scientists has discovered that the comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko has an aurora that glows in far ultraviolet light. The scientists found that the aurora is produced by solar wind particles interacting with gases that surround and radiate from the comet, known as a comet or tail. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Britain will face severe disruption at its ports and food shortages if it fails to strike a trade deal with the European Union before the end of the year. That's according to a new report. The Brexit transition period ends on December 31st of 2020, and relations are deteriorating as the deadline approaches, with Britain and the EU both accusing each other of negotiating in bad faith. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the coronavirus pandemic could compound the impact of a no-deal Brexit.
The Dover-Calais ferry and the Eurotunnel rail link are the vital arteries of Britain's trade with Europe. About 4 million trucks use the crossings every year. When the Brexit transition period ends, the majority of goods will require border checks, especially if there's no trade deal. The British government warned Wednesday that up to 60% of heavy goods vehicles, or HGVs, may not have the right paperwork.
They therefore be turned back by the French border authorities, clogging the Dover to Calais crossing. And in such circumstance, that could lead to queues of up to 7,000 HGVs in Kent.
80% of Britain's economy is made up of services. In London, banks and financial services are already prepared for no deal, says report author Jonathan Portes of King's College London's UK in a Changing Europe programme.
And so they've relocated legal entities, some staff and so on to deal with that.
JP Morgan is the latest bank to announce such a move this week, shifting $230 billion worth of assets from London to Germany. Britain's economy has already shrunk by a fifth this year, owing to the coronavirus pandemic. The ongoing effects could mask the impact of a no-deal Brexit, but the two could compound each other.
It'll be very difficult to interpret what's happening in the economic statistics and data because, of course, we are in this extraordinary period. Business and government have already got their hands full dealing with the consequences of COVID.
The border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland becomes an external frontier between Britain and the EU. There are fears any border checks here could trigger a return to sectarian violence. So instead, the withdrawal agreement signed by Britain and the EU last year mandated border checks down the Irish Sea in the event of a no deal. But London has introduced legislation to override that agreement, effectively breaking international law. Dublin has voiced dismay.
There's a growing sense that perhaps the UK doesn't want a deal, and that this is more about managing the blame game as the negotiations fail.
Britain insists it still wants a deal, but one that guarantees sovereignty.
Change requires preparation, but change is what the British people voted for.
The EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, visited London Wednesday for informal talks ahead of a ninth round of official negotiations next week. Analysts note that even if a deal is achieved, it won't be comprehensive, and disruption is likely whatever the outcome. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
With more than 32 million cases of COVID-19 tracked across the world, healthcare professionals in the Northern Hemisphere are urging people to be ready for what's been termed a twindemic, the confluence of the coronavirus and the seasonal flu. Dr. Andrew Pakosh, virologist, professor, and vice chair of the Department of Molecular and Microbiology and Immunology, as well as the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center of Excellence for Influenza Research and Surveillance, says that if one is beginning to feel respiratory symptoms this fall in the Northern Hemisphere, and they're starting to get severe,
first and foremost, contact your doctor, your local healthcare provider. Let them know what your symptoms are and have them guide you through the process of where you're going to go to get tested and for what. I think that's the most important thing to do. Don't wait too long before you contact them, but try not to just go directly to your doctor's office because, again, we want to make sure that if people are sick, that they're not exposing others inadvertently, that there's a controlled way to bring them into healthcare providers so they can get their treatments and their testing.
But what if someone gets both COVID-19 and the flu?
That's been something that's been on public health monitoring systems for a long time. We have not seen a large number of those co-infections, but that's probably because we've seen a dramatic drop in influenza cases, both here in the Northern Hemisphere at the end of last winter and in the Southern Hemisphere. We attribute that probably to the public health interventions, but it is something to pay attention to.
Healthcare professionals have said it is important to take this year's flu vaccine, but is there concern about interactions between it and should a COVID-19 vaccine become available?
Well, you know, we don't have the data yet on the current COVID vaccine clinical phase three clinical trials to sort of look at some of those things. Biologically speaking, there should be no interaction between those two. They're very different viruses that induce very different immune response. And we really don't have any data right now to suggest that those two immune responses would interact in any way, either beneficial or detrimental.
VOA has ongoing pandemic coverage available on our website. Australian bank Westpac has agreed to pay a record fine for the nation's biggest breach of anti-money laundering laws. The case was brought by the government's Australian Transaction Reports and Analysis Center, known as AUSTRAC. It said the penalty of more than $900 million sent a strong message to the financial industry to take compliance seriously. Phil Mercer takes it from here.
Westpac was accused by government investigators of 23 million breaches of money laundering and counter-terrorism financing laws. Australia's second largest bank was found to have allowed transactions that were potentially linked to child exploitation in the Philippines and in other countries, despite being specifically warned of the risks. If approved by the federal court, the $920 million fine will be easily the biggest in Australian corporate history. The bank had set aside $630 million to pay the penalty, but that figure was rejected as insufficient by the financial crimes watchdog. AUSTRAC investigators said the bank's non-compliance was serious and systemic. Australian Attorney General Christian Porter said he believes the agreed-to settlement, which he described using the Australian dollar amount, is fair.
My very strong view and the government's strident view was that the early appropriations that Westpac made and the figures that were being put early in negotiations with AUSTRAC were totally inadequate, and that this $1.3 billion amount more properly reflects both the seriousness of the offending that Westpac had engaged in, but also an acceptance of the fact that these represent some of the greatest failures of a corporate entity in Australia's history to abide by Australian law.
Westpac has apologised for its failings. Chief Executive Peter King said the bank was committed to fixing the issues to ensure that these mistakes don't happen again. The bank's former chief executive and chairman left their positions last year over the scandal. Opposition politicians are demanding the government push ahead with reforms to further strengthen Australia's anti-money laundering legislation. Last year, Australia's banking industry was scrutinised by a royal commission, the highest form of public inquiry, that exposed widespread dishonesty in the sector. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Mid-year stock taking by the Switzerland-based Internal Displacement Monitoring Center finds escalating conflict and violence in the first half of this year have triggered an upsurge in the numbers of people fleeing their homes and becoming newly displaced within their own countries. Lisa Schlein has the details.
Around 14.6 million people in 127 countries have been newly displaced between January and July because of natural and man-made disasters. This is about 1 million more than in the first half of last year. The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center report finds conflict and violence have sparked around one-third or 4.8 million new displacements, mainly in Africa and the Middle East. IDMC Director Alexandra Bilak says Syria tops the rank of countries with the highest increase in newly displaced. She says the military offensive in the country's northwest province of Idlib has prompted more than 1.4 million civilians to flee their homes.
DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, that also has seen a sharp increase in violence and armed violence and insecurity, particularly in its northeastern province of Ituri, which has also led to, as Syria, 1.4 million new displacements.
Bilek says Burkina Faso, with nearly a half million newly displaced, has become the worst displacement crisis in West Africa as armed conflict has expanded across the region. She expresses alarm at the rapidly deteriorating situations in Cameroon, Mozambique, Niger, and Somalia. She says growing conflict and violence in these countries have resulted in more new displacements in the first half of this year than in all of 2019. But she notes the situation of Yemen, currently considered the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe, remains of particular concern.
Although the numbers for Yemen are low, the reported numbers are low, we are highlighting the triple crisis that Yemen faces right now in the form of course, this ongoing and persistent conflict that has been exacerbated by high infection rates of COVID-19, as well as more recently some of the worst floods that the country has experienced in years.
Indeed, the report finds slow and sudden onset of natural disasters around the world have triggered 9.8 million new displacements. It reports cyclones in India and Bangladesh, floods and swarms of locusts in East Africa, devastating wildfires in Australia and the United States have resulted in the forced evacuations of millions of people in fear of their lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
TikTok's owner says it's applied for a Chinese technology export license as it tries to complete a deal with Oracle and Walmart to keep the popular video app operating inside the United States. AP correspondent Zaria Shackley has that story.
Beijing tightened control over technology exports last month in an effort to gain leverage over Washington's attempt to force an outright sale of TikTok to U.S. owners. The White House says the video service is a security risk because the personal information of its millions of U.S. users could be handed over to Chinese authorities. President Donald Trump said this week he would approve a proposed deal in which Oracle and Walmart could initially own a combined 20% of a new U.S. entity, TikTok Global. I'm Zaria Shackley.
As time runs out for the surviving stranded whales, Australian officials are turning to the grim task of how to dispose with nearly 400 carcasses after a huge mass stranding off Tasmania. Reuters' Lucy Fielder reports.
One of the luckier beached whales is towed out to sea. They were still hoping to rescue the few remaining survivors on Thursday and have managed to free almost 90 of the long-finned pilot whales beached off Australia's remote southern coast. Most have reached deeper water, but four had to be euthanized, and there are fears some might swim back to shore when the tide turns.
I think beyond the next 24 hours, any remaining animals that are alive will be less viable.
The clock is ticking for the rest, still floundering in shallow water on a wide sandbank, 4 days after the 470-strong pod was first spotted off the island state of Tasmania. And disposing of the dead whales is no easy task, even aside from the emotional toll the work is taking on the rescue team. Marine biologist Vanessa Pirotta.
Dealing with over 400 dead whales is a real problem. There are a number of things that they can do. For example, they can tow them out to sea, but they would have to be very far out so we don't ensure that the bodies re-strand. You could leave the bodies there to decompose. However, that does present a bit of a warning for swimmers in the area not to hop in the water because this could attract sharks, which is all part of the natural ecosystem, obviously. Or another option could be, after taking genetic samples or other biological samples, to remove the carcasses and bury them inland, away from the sea.
Lucy Fielder reports for Reuters News. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, have a great day, and a super weekend.